Welcome to the On Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Matt Moore, as Tara Reid says, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers around the world.
Yeah, day late, but yeah, I wrote a big thing on Facebook about my mom and my wife, and mothers are, being a parent, I don't know how I would do as a single, I know that there are single dads, and man, God bless y'all, and there are single moms, and God bless y'all, but I don't know how I would do without my toddler would kill me. He would.
Your toddler would become Chucky.
He would actually. It would be intentional, but he'd be like, "Play, Daddy," and then he would slice my Achilles, and I'd be on the floor, unable to move, and that's how it would end. But yeah, I am extremely excited today. I was listening to your podcast with Tim Bontemps last week.
Yes,
which was the most prophetic thing I think you have ever done.
Was it?
Everything that you and Tim talked about basically happened in that Heat Nets game three.
Here's what I know about Mirza Teletovic. I love him, and I believe that his 3-point shooting can guide everybody to anything they want to do.
We need a statue of him somewhere, like outside an arena statue, like one in the middle of a square. Like, okay, maybe Lennon's a bad example, but like someone.
Yeah, maybe let's tone it down a little bit there.
I have a written list of things to talk to you about. I am so excited. You know what is not on that list, though? Hmm. We are not talking about Donald Sterling outside of us talking about not talking about it.
No, I'm so sick of it.
He's going away. He's not going to win. Yeah. Adam Silver is stronger than him. The end.
Yeah.
What do you want to talk to you about? So let's start here. Tom Silver's got a thing up this morning that talks about grit. And so Gar Foreman of the Bulls said basically grit's our number one priority. And everyone's like, that's hilarious because you should probably go for talent. But Ziller goes through, there's like a TED talk about it and a bunch of research has been done about grit in terms of perseverance. And I kind of want to start talking to you about, I don't believe that the 2009-2010 Lakers, the 2008-2009 team I think was, but the 2009-2010 team, the Lakers, I don't think that was a great team. I think the Heat are a great team, but I don't think they're a gritty team.
Okay. I guess what makes a team a gritty team?
And if you're wondering, like, is this like, you know, because this could go into some really annoying hot sports takes. What I'm more trying to get at is it does frustrate me to a certain degree that essentially you can piss off the Heat as much as you want and they never respond. They only respond to basically personal turmoil, right? So
right.
LeBron's legacy is on the line. He's about to be eliminated. Everyone's going to completely destroy him for losing to the Celtics in 2012, and he responds in game six.
Yes.
With the absolute destruction game, right?
Right.
You know, they come up against – whenever they come up – like game six last year, like, oh, the Spurs are better. They're going to beat them. They find the way to respond.
Yes.
But things like – I was really disappointed in the fact that Chris Bosh basically got punked by everyone on the Nets. That Joe Johnson comes out and says, you know, without Dwayne and LeBron, we're a more talented team. And then the Heat show like a Raptors game in which Bosh went off in the locker room, which I was like, maybe not go back to the Raptors. Not ideal. And then he really got his ass kicked in that game. And I do like that. You know, Pierce made a big deal of, we're not afraid of them. We're not afraid of them. And LeBron's response on Sunday was like, it's basketball. We're not in a war. No. Like, what are you talking about?
Right.
I like that. But I wish that they would respond with a little bit more force when somebody decides to challenge them.
Here's what I like about it. I like the psychological aspect of it, of you're not going to get into our head. Like, no matter what, it's very Spursian, right? Like, if anything, they've become more Spursian as they've gotten more successful, which I think smart teams do, is nope, what in God. If anybody would ask Eric Spoelstra a pregame question, he would talk about the process. The process, the process, the process. That's all he talks about. That's all they talk about. And it's true. Like, they believe in the process of what they're doing. It also helps they have the best player in the world on their team, but they believe in the process of what they're doing. And that matters more than all of these individual scuffles. Now, that doesn't mean they don't get into them from time to time because they are still – I mean, they're not Spursian in the fact that these guys still have emotions. They still have reactions to things. They're not robots or cyborgs or anything. But they do, aside from those little individual emotive times, like, they still just, nope, we're good, we know we're good, we know we're better, we just have to do what we do. And, yeah, they got their, I mean, they just looked, not that, and I always hate going to this, because I don't want to take away from what the Nets did, because the Nets did outplay them, but they just looked like, they didn't look engaged to me, you know? Yeah. It looked very, we can probably take care of this. And they kind of waited around too long, and the Nets got hot, and the Nets moved, and not just got hot shooting, like, they got hot moving the ball, right? Like, you can get hot as a team making passes, which I think we don't talk enough about. Like, you can kind of get that into that intuitive, like, oh, nope, this is where the pass needs to go, even though they're trying to push it here. And you can get hot that way, and that can lead to better shooting and better shots. And I thought the Nets did that. But for me, like, Heat just looked like, we'll turn it on when we turn it on. And then it became too late, and then they couldn't do it. And I think that was the problem.
Yeah, and I totally agree. They weren't engaged. And I do with you on the hot passing thing. That's a really great point. And I get from the perspective of, we're not going to let you in your heads. It's funny that you mentioned the Spurs, because one of the things I'd written down was, I find it remarkable how the Nets are down 2-1, and Paul Pierce is running his mouth about the Heat, who he has not beaten since the Triad came into existence. Since those three came together, he's never beaten them, and he's running his mouth. Meanwhile, the Spurs are up 3-0 and have obliterated all hope. Whew. They have taken out the sun from the Blazers' universe. Like, that galaxy does not have a sun. There's no sun in that solar system. There's no light anymore. They're in total darkness. It's Chronicles of Riddick there.
Like, granted, I thought I was a little worried about the Spurs after that series against the Mavericks, because I just didn't see it going that way. I didn't think they would need a seventh game, you know. I didn't think they would struggle so much. So I was riding high on the Blazers. I was riding a little low on the Spurs. I still thought the Spurs would win the series, but I was very up in the air about it. And now I just feel like the Spurs were just messing with us. I really feel like you can't just flip a switch like that. And I know it's different defense and different schemes and a different coach and all that crap, but I just don't feel like you can flip a switch like that.
Pop came out and said on Saturday, you know, we were really more prepared to play Portland than we were Dallas. And I was like, that's really interesting. I go back and find the rest of the comments on that. But I've said this on radio a couple times. I really do believe that after game 5, they had a practice, and Popovich was basically like, okay. Like, not angry, not screaming, just, I understand. It's been a long season. I understand. It's hard to make the adjustment. We have to go now. It's time. And everyone was like, okay. And then they just – because, you know, game 6 was they had to win that game.
Yeah.
You know, they had to win that game. And they did. And then game 7 was, well, you know, it was a strong performance, but they were at home. Dallas kind of ran out of steam. The Spurs made adjustments. But you didn't feel really good about him. And then after, like, game 1 of Spurs-Blazers, I was like, oh. Like, they actually did do something and turned – whether it was an adjustment, an effort thing, whatever it was, that switch did get flipped. But my original point was, while Paul Pierce is running his mouth down 2-1 to a team he's never beaten, the Spurs have annihilated this Blazers team. And Tony Parker on after game 3 was like, man, Damian Lillard's a really tough cover. Like, he's so good.
Right. If anything, like, that's more frustrating. The fact that you're getting destroyed and they're complimenting you. Like, that would be demoralizing. I think it's a psychological tactic. I think they have respect for the Blazers, but I think that's, man, these guys, they're so good. It's like, you're winning by 20. No, they're not. I mean, they are good, but, like, compared to you, no, they're not.
They haven't cracked 100 offensive efficiency. Right. They haven't cracked 100.
Right. This is the guy breaking up with the girl and going, I'm so jealous of the next guy that gets to be with you. That's what this is.
Yeah, I mean... And so that's like the interesting comparison. And then, you know, and then the Nets have the gall. I do kind of like, I like this though. I like this comparison. Like, I'm not, like, I act annoyed at it, but I love the fact that this is a thing, because they have the gall to then go out and say, yeah, Pierce asked to check LeBron. Yeah. Like, the Nets are just like, what are you going to do? Huh? What are you going to do about it? And this, and, you know, let's go back to the big thing you talked about with Bontemps. And I'm on board too, like Teletovic. I went into the playoffs going, is Mirza Teletovic a thing? And everyone's like, what does that mean? I'm like, well, there are role players that are like a thing in the regular season, and then the playoffs come, and then they are no longer a thing. And then there are guys that, no, like, this is something you have to worry about. This is an entity on this team, a dynamic that is actually significant. And Mirza Teletovic is significant. Mirza Teletovic is more significant in this series and in these playoffs for this team than Kevin Garnett.
Oh, yeah. I completely agree, which it's just demoralizing for me as a Garnett fan. But, and I'll bleep this out. Seriously, guess how many f***s Mirza Teletovic gives? Zero. Absolutely zero. Like, this dude just comes in gunning. Like, gunning. And they're not bad shots either. Like, no. Some of them are very contested, but he's, you know, 6'8", 6'9". He can get his shot off. He's a high release point, and he has a quick release. And he knows that once he gets the shot off, like, it's pure. There's a reason 65% of his career attempts are threes. Like, this dude just is confident. He's tweeting out a shot chart. Today he said, check my things on YouTube. Like, he's a confident guy who's gone through a lot in life. So, like, basketball is a game to him. And it's incredible how, like, he's just so calm.
And he did fantastic work defensively on LeBron. Like, you talked about him, the comparison with him with Novak, with Bontemps, and the thing I kept thinking was, you can't keep Novak on the floor. Right. That's the problem. You can solve Novak really easily. It's just, look, we're going to defend four guys with four guys. And we're going to keep somebody home on Novak, and that's it.
And like, I think that's where you kind of – where your point about there are guys who are things in the regular season, guys who are just things, you know? Yeah. Novak is more of a guy who's a thing in the regular season.
Yeah.
Because you can't keep him on the floor. But Mirza, you can.
So two things about Mirza. One, and this is kind of gets back to that first thing about the grit thing. Here's what I want to see the Heat do. I legitimately – and they will never do this. And LeBron will say, no, I don't want to do this. That's stupid. We're going to stick with what works, blah, 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 blah. I do – this is the one – and I almost always side with LeBron. Like, I love the fact he wants to make the right play and he plays team basketball. It's one of the reasons that aesthetically he appeals to me more than most of the other major superstars of the last 30 years. Like, I really love that approach. At the same time, I really want him to be like, we're going five out. We're putting one guy in the corner, one guy on the wing, one guy on the elbow, all of them weak side, and one guy at the top of the key. You're putting me in single coverage on Teletovic on the left side, and I'm going to kill him. Like, yeah. Every single time, clear out ISO. Be like, you cannot help off. If you help off, we're getting a shot. And just be like, you want to guard me with Mirza Teletovic? Let's see you guard me with Mirza Teletovic. But he won't do it. Like, that's what I really want to see. From the shooting perspective, you're absolutely right. He keeps taking great shots. I want to ask you, as a gunner, this has been a thing I've noticed in this round more than any other. It was in real stark relationship to John Wall's shot that he passed up last night.
Mm.
I always talk about, like, you got to hit quality shots. Like, you can't just, you know, you can't just gun. Like, it's not sustainable. Even if you hit them, you can't knock them down. But I will say this. A guy running you off, I feel, is a lesser contest, and that you need to have more confidence in shooting that shot than taking it when the guy is right in front of you, even if he's shorter.
It's all about – it depends. I mean, I know you love this phrase. It's case by case. It's something where – it's something where it depends on the guy and his release point and the space. Like, I truly believe that the reason – Steph Curry is such an amazing shooter is he knows if you're not going to truly block the shot, then it's not a real contest to him. And there are some guys who have that confidence of if there is space to get the shot off, it doesn't matter what the guy is doing, how he's flying at you. If you know it's not going to get blocked, then you know, then it's a good shot. And I think Mirza is one of those guys. Now, it's also, I'm of the belief that I don't think it matters if your shot gets blocked at all. Like, I think, like, to me, like, your shot gets blocked on a jumper, it's probably going to fall short, whereas, you know, a lot of shots inside are going to get blocked out of bounds or something. But, like, to me, like, all right, the guy beat you, you still have to have the confidence to get that shot off. And in normal times
there's like a 25% chance you'll draw the foul. Right. In these playoffs, there's like a 150% chance. Right. You'll draw the foul.
Yeah, exactly. Like, now you can shoot the shot and then lean to the side and fall down, and it doesn't matter if you get hit or not. They're going to call the foul, which is amazing. But I do believe that – I think it depends on the player of – there are some guys where I think it's a good idea for them to take that run off the three-point line, dribble in and take the shot or drive. There are some shooters where I just think it's – no, you know you're getting the shot off. Go for it.
At the same time, Teletovic's I believe in, and that's what got them hot, and that's why they won that game – 15 of 25 is unsustainable. Like,
oh, completely unsustainable.
And that's where I keep – I'm really curious to see what happens in game four, because the Nets are the type of team that can take an unsustainable performance and turn it into a consistent trend. They can build on it.
Yeah.
But if those shots do not fall and that does not happen and they rely on unsustainable concepts, the Heat can win this game. And then all of a sudden it's going to go from LeBron saying Sunday, well, this is a series now, to – well, the series is over now. Like, really quick.
The thing that troubles me about the Nets shooting going from last game to tonight's game is not a lot of them came in the corner.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a – when you're giving up these corner threes, that's a defensive breakdown, you know, whereas – and there were a lot that were uncontested above the break, but I think they were like something like 11 of 18 above the break in game three. That's just not a good shot. You know, I mean, it obviously depends on the context of the possession, but for the most part, like, you want to get those shots in the corner or you want to get those shots from straight away, and a lot of them came on the wings, and that can be okay, but to me, that's just so much less sustainable. But like you said, the Nets do build off stuff like this, so maybe it will be sustainable for the next game. For the rest of the series, no, that's crazy. But for the next game, yeah, maybe they can even up by doing this.
I also thought it was interesting because you talked about how Teletovic annoys LeBron with Bontemps, and
I love it.
LeBron does this very rarely. He's done it, I think, three times I can remember since I started. And I started with CBS at, like, I think 7 days before the decision. He's not done it with the Heat almost at all. He said, James Jones needs to play more. I don't know why he's not playing more. I can't think of a reason why he's not playing.
Yeah.
I am not going six games with these. I am not doing this.
Right. And that's something too. I mean, James Jones is, that guy's a shooter. Like that guy, that, I mean, he was 3 of 3, and they're just like, they're running him off these screens where the Nets knew that they were trying to get the ball to him. Like, he wasn't a decoy. Like, they knew he was trying to get the ball to him, and he did it. And he still hit the shots. I mean, that is a legitimate weapon. I would much rather them go to James Jones than to Rashard Lewis. But I did notice this. Like, I kind of like Rashard Lewis defending Joe Johnson.
Really?
I kind of liked it. Like, I don't think it's – like, it's nothing I do for 20 minutes. But for a few possessions here and there, I just thought his length bothered Joe at times.
You want to know what – here's my problem. The Nets keep running the underneath routes, and what happens is Rashard gets down and hits somebody, and then it's like he makes contact with someone, and it's like in the cartoon where the bird knocks into the pole and then has – the bird has miniature Tweety birds around its head.
Right.
Like he just gets lost, and then on rebounds, he's getting murdered. Like, there was like four or five plays in that third and fourth quarter where I was like, why is Rashard Lewis on the floor? I know you're going to hate this idea, and I recognize what he did to that Wolves team. I want to give Beasley a five-minute stretch.
There's just no reason to do it.
I don't – here's the thing. Your concern with Beasley is basically he's going to do stupid stuff, particularly offensively, but there's a threat for defensively too. I get that. I don't feel like he's going to feel confident enough to be like – I think he understands his role and isn't going to be like, oh, I've got to step up and make shots here. I think he's going to be like, oh, hey, here's the ball. Where's LeBron? And that's all you need. Like, he needs to have a 5 minute trillion. That's what he needs to do. He needs to have a 5 trillion. Don't try and rebound. Don't try and shoot. Don't try and get fouled. All you need to do is give effort and let everyone else do their thing. Because that's the problem, is I feel like some of these role players for the Heat, they just kind of get in the way. Rashard Lewis, I feel like, gets in the way.
Here's I do have a pretty nuanced like response to that.
He sucks.
Just no. My response is no. I understand what you're saying. I think you can do that next round against Lance Stephenson and against Evan Turner. I think you can roll that card out there. I don't think you can do it against a veteran team like this.
Okay.
You can't put him against Pierce. You can't put him against Joe Johnson. You can't put him against Sean Livingston. You can't put him on Mirza. Like, you can't put him against Kirilenko. Like, there's not a – maybe you could put him against Blatch, but even then, that's kind of dangerous.
By the way, Heat fans went ballistic on me for basically saying Wade has trouble covering Joe Johnson in the post. Yeah. Wade's getting murdered by Sean Livingston in the post.
Right. Like, Wade isn't the athlete he used to be. He's still strong, but he isn't the athlete he used to be. So the fact that you have a 6'4", 6'5", shooting guard hurts you against those taller players. Like, Joe Johnson's what, 6'7"? And he's got good reach. Sean Livingston's like 6'8", has a good reach. Like, this is there's just a logistical hype problem.
Where you were with Kevin Garnett in 2011, I am with Dwayne Wade in 2014.
Yeah.
That's where I'm at. Where it's like you can see the big drop-off coming, and you're just trying to deny it for as long as possible.
Right.
Like there's going to reach a point – this next contract's going to be bad for the Heat, and I think they should still sign him to it. I do believe that there's got to be a point where you're like, the guy's won you between – 3 and 4 championships, depending on what happens this year. Like,
I think you have to sell them on a reverse timeshare where you're just like, hey, how great would a 1 year deal be?
We'll pay you all of the money for 1 year.
Right.
We'll give even if he was willing to just be like, you know what, I'm probably done in 2. We'll do 2 with an option for 3.
Yeah. I mean, the 4th year is going to be awkward.
Like, this is big, too, because it's like, he's going to wind up working in that front office. Like, it's going to be him and Zoe coming to work in that office
for
the next 20 years.
Absolutely. Like,
that's what it's going to be. And I hope it goes kind of smoothly. I have this to talk to you about, and is absolutely not connected to anything that we're discussing, but I need to get your thoughts on it. Someone suggested, I think it was Howard Beck. It may have been Amin El Hassan. Someone suggested the other day that Draymond Green is Robert Horry.
I'd calm down on that a bit. I can see the similarities in young Robert Horry to current Draymond Green. I can see that, but I don't think they're enough of the same player.
Okay.
I think Horry was much more of a slasher. I think Draymond is naturally like a point forward type of player, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't really feel like Robert Horry was that in his early days with Houston.
He was also – it was crazy, though, because he was such a slasher. And that's one of the weird things is people watched him so much more in those later years, like with the Spurs and everything. And, like, I was in college, so it was hard for me to watch consistently. Like, my memories of Robert Horry are always of, like, that thin guy for the Rockets that was, like, slashing and making big shots from the outside and grabbing rebounds. Like,
yeah, and he was, like, a terror in the passing lanes. And stuff. You know, like, he was a guy that he was just – I don't know. Like, to me, he was such more of a weapon because he was so lanky.
Yeah.
And Draymond's just more...
Josh Smith wasn't an idiot. Like,
right, exactly. If Josh Smith knew how to play within himself, that would have been Robert Horry. But I think that... I think Draymond's much more of a power player, you know?
Yeah. Let's talk Blazers.
Do it.
Because I thought this was... I stumbled onto this line of thinking on Saturday night, and like I got accused of trolling. First of all, I really want to make this clear. If I'm saying it and I'm not in your timeline, I don't know how I'm trolling you. Like, I don't ask you to follow me. I'm aware that Blazers fans follow me, but I'm not thinking of you when I tweet this. I'm just being like, oh, this is something that's in my head right now. Because my basic thing is I like where this Blazers team is at. I think it's good for the franchise that they made the second round. That Dame game 6 shot is going to go down in history. Even though it's a first round game, that's how cool that shot was. Aldridge is going to be 29 this summer. Batum's 26, Matthews is 27. That's your core outside Dame.
Yes.
You don't have any. You have CJ McCollum, who we got to see. You've got Will Barton, who hasn't exactly exploded in the first 2 years. So really, your only real core of young guys is just Dame. I'm pretty sure Lopez is what, 24,
25. I think Lopez is older than that.
My thing is, and everyone's like, the response was, that's not old. And I was like, I didn't say that. I'm not saying that they're the Nets. I'm not saying their prime has passed. My issue is I don't know how to take a team that's been this bad defensively with this core of players at this age and say, oh, they're going to improve to the level they need to get to in order for them to go not just to the championship. Like, let's scale it back a bit. To make the Western Conference Finals, how do you turn that core of players into that? Like, the Clippers, I could see, because it was like, look, Blake's 22, DJ's 23, and now it's like, well, Blake's 24, DJ's 25. Like, they're hitting that mark where they're now starting to be really effective defensive players. The Blazers guys are already past that part. Can they get there? Can they get to the point where they can make the Western Conference Finals because of their defense?
Here's the example that came to mind. And this – I don't know if this is going to make any sense, but this is what popped in my head. To me, it makes sense. Back in like 2001 or 2002, there was not a debate, but in my head that there was this kind of decision that the Kings need to make about would you rather roll with Peja Stojakovic or Hedo Turkoglu moving forward? And for some reason, I just felt like it was one or the other. And it really doesn't make any sense. But at the time, like that's what I thought. And for me, it was I don't see Peja getting necessarily better as a player but he could get more experience and learn that way. Hedo, I thought, was just more versatile and could get better as a player, right? Like, there's like there you could see grounds for like legitimate skill improvement and versatility. And to me, like, I thought that kind of movement going forward, that kind of progression moving forward, would be more important than trying to get Peja to be more of a fine-tuned player. Now, it turns out Peja got better just from experience. Like, he didn't really improve skill-wise, but he figured out how to use that skill much, much better, much more effectively than previously, and had, you know, an MVP caliber year in 2003, 2004 when they didn't have Weber for most of the year. And that was on display of his understanding of the game became so much better. And with this Blazers team, in this situation, they would be Peja, of the sense of, yeah, I don't see how they can get a whole lot, you know, more diversified in the things they do on the court, i.e., like becoming a great defensive team by having the weapons that they need. But I can see them just by being together and having continuity and building that chemistry, you know, further and further. I think that they can kind of improve in a way Peja Stojakovic improved, in the sense of, you just get better by learning to do what you do in a more effective way, if that makes sense.
It does. No, and that's a really interesting comparison. I think, you know, a part of it, I think the CBA has changed a lot of this stuff.
Yes.
Because of what winds up happening. The other thing, and this is, Blazers fans are going to hate this because they just got off of this ledge. Look, LaMarcus knows he's only got, you know, he's a big man that shoots mid-range jumpers. And while LaMarcus isn't dependent on athleticism, that stuff does end up, like, he's also doesn't have physical tools to kind of help boost his career along. He's got probably 4 more years of being a force. Now, he can be one of the best players in the league for the next 4 years. But after 33, we're going to start seeing a pretty significant decline.
Right.
He can still play. Like, LaMarcus is taking good care of his body. Like, he hasn't played extensive minutes because they haven't made the playoffs. He's in good shape. There's got to be a point, like, this could be tough for him to go into free agency next year. Now, they can get him an extension. It's cool. Everything's fine. Like, they might be able to just be like, look what we've got. And he could be like, you know what? I love it here. I've stuck with this team. You guys did what I asked you to do, which is to build a good team around me. I love playing with Dame. Cool. But there's probably got to be a part of him that goes, I don't know if this team is ever going to get there. And if it's never going to get there, I've got to go where I can.
And see, that's where I think that seeing the way Damian Lillard has already, he seems to soak up that experience and learn from it, you know, at a quicker rate than most young guards. And it's probably because he's already 23, 24 years old. I think that by looking at that, I think you can, for him, he can feel confident of, all right, when I hit the tail end, when I start declining at 32, 33, Damian's going to be like, you know, just entering his prime / in the middle of his prime, right? Yeah. And I think that the more responsibility you give Lillard as those two kind of intersect, I think it can be fine.
I think it can be fine. I think it's something to keep an eye on, especially, like, I hate to go down this road. I want the Blazers to keep him. I think the Blazers are a great franchise. I love that crowd. I think it's amazing. It's awesome. I just, the Lakers and Knicks are going to have money in 2015. Like,
certainly, yeah.
It's just a thing, and I just think that that's something to be concerned with, because, you know, depending on what happens with Love, the other team's going to have lots of money and be like, well, you know, we didn't get Kevin Love, but yeah, we can get the guy who's arguably better than him.
And don't take this the wrong way, but not you, but just people listen, like, don't take this the wrong way, but someone's got to be the Amari of that free agent class, right?
Right.
Or that free agency situation. Like, someone's got to be Amari.
So I just think it's something to keep an eye on. And hey, maybe the Blazers will come back from 3 down and win the series. And
yeah, they could be the first team in 109 teams to do it.
Against the San Antonio Spurs.
Right.
Having to go on the road.
Against the best franchise of the last 15 years.
Sounds likely. You know, also it sounds likely, Andrew Bynum being a goddamn poison.
That's a shocker. That's a bit of a shocker to me. The fact it is weird.
3-0, Zach.
It is, and not just 3-0. It's weird that he leaves, and all of a sudden Roy Hibbert's good again. And it can be completely coincidental. I would love to talk to Roy about this. It could be completely coincidental, but there were, you know, whispers that he was unhappy with him signing Bynum, right? And before they signed Bynum, they're one of the best teams in the league, and Roy Hibbert has the best net rating on that team at plus 13.2 points per 100 possessions. And after they signed him, he's at like a minus 0.1 or a plus 0.1. I can't remember which one. Like, he fell 13 points in impact. And that is, that doesn't tell everything, but you look at, like, before, like, yeah, he was an okay offensive player. Not good, but he was serviceable. And after that, he was a mess. And then they part ways, and all of a sudden Roy Hibbert can score again. And he's scoring, like, as good as Paul George was in that second half, and Paul George was the main reason they won, like, Roy Hibbert hit some huge shots in the second half. He played incredible basketball. It's weird. It's really weird.
In the last three games, Zach, they are minus 23.3 with Roy off the floor and plus 24.1 with him on. They are 47 points better with Roy Hibbert on the floor in the three games since Andrew Bynum left.
I'm no basketball expert, but that is a significant amount of points.
And I hate, you know, I've been painted in this corner as basically the Roy Hibbert defender, which is really weird. And, like, Heat fans are all on me, and they're like, you're a Heat hater and a Pacer lover. And I'm like, Dwayne Wade and Alonzo Mourning are in my top three all time. What is wrong with you? But I do love the fact that Twitter was like a raging inferno when Hibbert was sucking, and now he's good, and it's just not – so many people have so much less to say on Twitter with Roy Hibbert not sucking. It's weird.
It started to crop up in the first half last night because he was bad in the first half, and then he had an amazing second half, and it got real quiet again.
And he said, like, a heckler got him going. I'm just like, ugh. And then he was, like, totally trolling. He was just trolling everyone. It's interesting, and it's crazy because they lost game one. It's like, well, here we go again. You know, the Pacers just haven't fixed anything. And then they've now won three straight, and the Wizards are see, here's the problem. And I wrote about this a little bit last night in terms of everyone's like, oh, the inexperienced. And I'm like, really? Because Al Harrington was on the floor for 10 minutes in the fourth quarter last night.
Drew couldn't play a lot, too.
You know. Al Harrington is from the Mesozoic era. Like, it goes back a ways.
By the way, small sample size theater, but in the last three games, all wins. Roy Hibbert is shooting 64.7% from the field. Dare I say playoff Hibbert?
Playoff Hibbert? Playoff Hibby? But yeah, so the problem with, I think, the Wizards is that, yes, they have veterans with lots of experience. The problem is the veterans that they have are also the type of guys that are going to be like, oh, this thing's over. Like, that's the flip side of experience, is you're also not dumb enough to know when you're beaten, because Andre Miller, I guarantee you right now, is calling for his timeshare in Florida. Like, because that's where old people go, get it? Like, Al Harrington, Drew Gooden, those guys are making plans because they know what's up. Like, John Wall may be like, we can still win this thing, right? Right? And Martell Webster's like patting him on the head, like, yeah, sure, John, we can win. We can do it. We're only down 3-1. It's cool. But, like, I would not be shocked if Indiana closes this thing out in five. And then here's what's nuts. We went from the Pacers are in total disarray, the Heat have total control, and three days later, you realize the Pacers could get like a 5-day break before the Eastern Conference Finals, where they have home court versus Miami, who may have to go the distance with Brooklyn.
Yikes. I mean, all right, they won't have to go the distance with Brooklyn, but I mean, that's just not going
to
happen. But
I'm trying to be nice to Brooklyn. I'm trying not to be like,
we could be nice to Brooklyn while being realistic. That's just not.
This is looking pretty gentlemanly, if you know what I'm saying.
If they can, I mean, if Brooklyn wins tonight, then I guess we can have that conversation, but I got to see more than one 60% three-point shooting game. I still think, even with the Pacers looking better and getting confident, I still think the Heat have this, like, and have it handily. Because even with the matchup issues, I think the Heat just know – I mean, no offense to the Hawks and the Wizards, but the Heat are on another, you know, level of like, brave wing – or brain wavelength here. Like, it's just there's a difference between playing scrappy basketball and forcing the Pacers into you know, these problems, and playing almost a Hannibal-esque, like, psychotic, like, we're going to dissect you in the way that we know how to do.
Right.
But okay, it's fun to have. It's fun to have Indiana back.
Last thing, which is a very big topic. Oh my God, that game yesterday.
Jesus. I don't know. All right, I'm learning a theme here with this Clippers team. I don't know anything that happens in their playoff games anymore. I'm being asked on radio, like, what's going on? I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know how to analyze this team. I really don't. Like, good or bad. I don't know what to take away from the playoff games. All I know is they've been ridiculously fun.
I want this. It's really crazy because either the Thunder or the Clippers making the finals would be an incredible story. The Spurs would be, because I have serious doubts about a team losing the finals without the best player on the planet and making it back, and that would be a great story. But I'm also sick to death of watching the Spurs just murder people. It's just, it's gone from Hannibal the show, which is fun and kind of gruesome, to just depressing watching like those true life murder shows. It's just sad.
Right.
But man, like, both of these teams are battling such such basketball related adversity, and the Clippers are battling a lot of stuff going on outside of it, and it's just really compelling stories. You tweeted last night in the fourth quarter, this feels like the biggest 6-point lead ever.
Yeah.
And I felt the same way, which I tweeted early in the fourth quarter. Even when they cut it to, I think, 12, I was like, this is just the Thunder being better than them. Like, they are just better than them. Nope. Clippers win.
I mean, here's the thing. Is like, all right, Chris Paul starts guarding Kevin Durant exclusively at basically the 11-minute mark of the fourth quarter. He checks back in the game. He goes straight to Durant, and they start guarding him. People are like, oh. And at first it was, oh, look at the good job Chris Paul's doing. And then it became a wild swing the other way of, people are going to assume that, you know, Chris Paul stopped him one-on-one, but this isn't the case. It's like, no, there's middle ground here, is that Chris Paul did a very good job on him. It didn't mean he stopped him, but the job he did in terms of positioning his body allowed the Clippers to trap, allowed them to delay the offense, allowed them to really put pressure on the Thunder to execute and execute late in the clock, and they didn't do it. And that was the genius part of it, is that, yeah, Chris Paul was great, but it happened because it was a good team effort. And also, you know, you love Westbrook. I love Westbrook. We both think he's a point guard. He is a point guard. To even consider that he's not a point guard is really stupid. Like, at this point in his career, it's just dumb. And you're talking about, like, pre-draft concerns at this point that have been disproven. But he did miss a lot of passes to Durant.
Yeah.
In that situation. Like, he missed a lot of passes, and he's got to be better as much as Durant's got to be better.
At the same time, I'm really annoyed that it's, why are they posting up Kevin Durant all the way from the basket? Because, let's start there. One, he's hit three massive shots in this series with Paul guarding him by basically getting the ball in that spot and turning around and taking the one-legged turnaround jumper. You could talk about, that's a tough shot. Not for Kevin Durant. That's his wheelhouse. Like, that's the, you know, Barkley was going nuts on this last night. Like, why are they getting him the ball there? And it's like, Charles knows this. Like, that's where he's comfortable. You get guys the ball where they're comfortable. Like, I'm all for giving Carmelo Anthony the ball out of that extended elbow and letting him isolate. My problem is when he doesn't ever take the opportunity to drive. He did this year, by the way. Good job, Carmelo. Tough year, etc. But that was a problem in years past. But for Durant, like, he's most comfortable being able to turn around and take that jumper, and he's going to hit it more times than not. That's not where they lost. He wasn't missing shots, posting up against Chris Paul and fading away. That's not where they lost it.
No, he was 3 of 4 in that stretch from the field, but he also had 3 turnovers.
Yeah, and that's the key here is, I agree that Scott Brooks has to be like, all right, look, we're gonna move guys here. We need to change our spacing. We've got to adjust to this double. Totally agree. I think it's on the other players to say, you know what, they're gonna bring that double. I better give Kevin a better passing lane and not just stand over here on the far wing with Jamal Crawford basically being like, please throw this pass, please. Please throw this pass.
And my thing is, like, all right, there's a certain point where you can't wait until 7 seconds are on the clock to give him the ball, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the problem, is that the positioning was so good, and they're making weird angles. He's fronting them, which allows the help defender to come from the backside and take away that pass. And so they're getting too late into the clock. I think you can move him down more towards the baseline, bring the passer over to the wing, And that, and it's not like necessarily getting him closer to the basket. It's just changing the angle, because that angle is much easier for, I think, the defense to shade the pass away, which, you know, becomes this positioning battle, which allows you to like to make the offense go deeper into the shot clock. Where I think is if they started maybe him more towards the baseline, and not necessarily deeper, but more towards the baseline, I just think it changes things for the defense, and it gives them a different look that you should try to do.
Here's another idea. How about Kevin Durant makes better passes? Sorry, there's another bleep.
I got three in this one.
But like, this is the thing that's driving me nuts. Is everyone's like, God, Scott Brooks, how could you turn the ball over? I'm like, Kevin Durant's the one that threw the ball. Like, don't throw the bad pass.
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather he fake going right and trying to pass over and then sidestep out of the post into a like sideways fadeaway jumper than him trying to make that pass. Because it was a horrible angle. He got it deflected anyway. It was a terrible execution the entire way. And I'm talking about three possessions for a guy that scored 40 points on 24 shots. So
yeah, he had a great game, but he also made some critical mistakes that led to the lose.
Yeah.
Led to them losing. Like it's
yeah, and if we're going to talk about those post possessions being the problem, I'm not going to sit here and say it's on Scott Brooks or it's on just the spacing or whatever. The guy that actually throws that pass is the one that gets tagged for that turnover for a reason. He's the one that threw that pass. He's got to be better with that.
I think Scott Brooks did an atrocious job adjusting in game.
Oh, he did.
I thought Westbrook was really bad at knowing when to throw the pass, and I thought Durant was making bad decisions when he wasn't shooting the ball.
Royce Young mentioned this on Daily Thunder. He said that he was like, you know, one big thing here is, you know, well, Darren Collison, who we'll get to in a minute, was murdering the Thunder at the other end. He was also guarding Russell Westbrook. So you can talk all you want about Kevin Durant being guarded by Chris Paul. Why isn't Russell Westbrook posting Darren Collison into oblivion?
He could just bully him. Like, he's got 40 pounds of muscle on him.
Yeah. Another thing, Thabo Sefolosha played 257 in the fourth quarter last night. What in the hell? Why would you not want that kind of defense? If you're going to say, look, we want to run this clock out. We're basically doing ball control offense here. Like, we are running the clock by running the ball. That's all we're trying to do. We're trying to kill timeouts and run this thing out. Why would you not want the long, athletic, lengthy guy that can occasionally knock down a few shots and is a premier defender?
And this is the thing. I tried to make this point. I don't know that I did it all that well, but it was I compared the decision to put Paul on Durant to the decision to put Steven Jackson on Dirk in 2007. And it was once you conform to what the other team wants to do, like, that's losing the battle, right? And they went, you know, they went small, and I get it. Like, you know, I'd rather not have Kendrick Perkins out there either. And Serge Ibaka was playing so well, like, I get that. But at a certain point, you can go small while still, like, taking Caron Butler out of there and putting Thabo in. Like, what's the difference there?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Thabo was, and God, it's single game plus minus, so who the hell knows? Like, this isn't a great example, but in 22 minutes, he was plus 18. Now, granted, most of that came in the first half when they killed him, but, I mean, they were good with him on the court. And it might have had nothing to do with him, but there was something there.
I'm annoyed because I feel like Thabo's earned this time, too.
Yeah, like, he's their best he's their best wing defender.
Things get tough for the Heat, when things get really tough for Miami, Spoelstra goes, "All right, UD, go." And Haslam doesn't complain about not playing. He's just like, "All right, let's go to work." And he comes in and he usually makes an impact. Like, Mike Miller was that guy for them last year. If there's one thing I have a concern for the Heat, I keep coming back to, man, they miss Mike Miller. They could really use that guy to be like, "It's cool. I'll come in, knock down some threes, play some defense, get some rebounds. We're good." I feel like Thabo's earned that. I'm not debating that. I think Caron overall has played pretty well. I think people flipped out a little bit too much about the ISOs for Caron because he was effective on a few of them early, and if something's working, I think you should go to it. But I just don't get why Thabo's not getting a little bit of this of the respect I think that he deserves for this kind of stuff. And the other thing is, I like Reggie Jackson. I think Reggie Jackson's a good player. He's going to have games where he's going to win them playoff games. Like, he did that in Game 3 to a large extent. He killed the Grizzlies, I think, in Game 4? Game 4, I think, is when he killed them. He was bad. And I did a whole breakdown of how Collison got loose on that layup that he got, because that one really kind of got glossed over by, one, the insanity of that final possession as the two coaches dueled with comparable idiot swords, basically just being like, how stupid can we be? But it gets lost. Darren Collison got a layup at the rim inside of a minute versus the Oklahoma City Thunder with Serge Ibaka right in front of him.
It was funny because he comes around on that and he hesitates, and he like it almost looked like he was, wait, is this lane really open or is this a trap? And he realized it was really open, so he had like the little hesitation of, let me look. Okay, yep, no, still open. And he went and got the layup, and I just couldn't believe that he had that much time to make a decision.
What was crazy is, Durant flies at him, he pump fakes and he goes around him, and he's got that moment, you're right, where he's like, should I drive? Like, well, I should take the jumper here, right? Like, I'm open for the jumper. And he was like, wait, I've got room. And he starts to drive, and he's going at both Ibaka and Jackson. Jackson backs away. Because Jackson's like, oh, I better go get Blake Griffin because I'm going to box out Blake Griffin.
Right.
By the way, Blake Griffin wound up shoving him, I think, like 4 feet on that play. So had he actually missed the layup, Blake was still getting the putback. And I actually don't blame Ibaka there. Ibaka didn't take a great angle, but I think Ibaka was like, oh, well, I don't have to go baseline because Reggie's there. And then Collison gets to the corner, and Ibaka's like, well, hell. And he lays it in. Yeah, I mean, the cherry pick was one thing. Like, that was just – they just fell asleep. Like,
right.
That was inexcusable. You can't have that happen. But this stuff does happen in NBA games. The guys just make mental mistakes. A lot of that, I think, was the Thunder were like, all right, we're in possession-by-possession mode. Like, that, you know how it gets, dude. It's like score, timeout, miss, timeout. Like, you go back and forth. And then the Clippers were like, nope.
No, we'll
get the lead. We're going to go.
We'll just take that fast guy streaking down the floor.
Yeah, that was the other thing. The Thunder, I really feel like they were ahead for so much of the game. They never really stopped to go, wait, we're down.
Right. Yeah, they seemed kind of bewildered by the moment.
Because when they locked in, because you could tell, like, they all, like, got set. Like, all right, we're going to defend this possession. And meanwhile, everyone at home is going, you need to foul them. What are you doing?
Right, and it seemed like, and I think people confused, like, being scared of the moment, like being rattled with being bewildered. Like, I don't think they were like, oh no, what do we do? I think it was kind of like, hey, how the hell did this happen? Like, where did this deficit come from?
So now we're in a weird place because I said this yesterday, Darren Collison didn't get any credit for what he did to Steph Curry in the first round because Curry had a good series. He didn't have what I think a lot of people expected, which was Human Torch, Inferno, oh my God, Curry. And and Collison really bothered him with how quick he was. He did legitimate work on that. And everyone was like, God, he's just getting killed by Westbrook. He can't even do anything against him. And I kept getting annoyed. Yes, I like Darren Collison overall, but this year I've been like, he's not – no, people are right. He's not very good. But I'm also like, blaming him for not being able to guard Russell Westbrook seems like an odd thing.
Yeah, like, I mean, then I guess nobody's a good defender.
Like, he goes around LeBron, like, no problem.
Right.
Just really weird. Blake Griffin, I thought, was really good. 10 points in that fourth quarter yesterday.
Yeah.
I liked seeing him step up and lead. That was really great. I liked Chris Paul after the game. Paul, since he came to the Clippers, he's been like, well, this is like, I wanted a big market, and this is the one that got me. I didn't get to go to the Lakers, so we'll make the best of this. But he's always been a little frustrated with the inexperience of Blake and DeAndre and kind of everything. He loves this team. This specific year, Paul seems to really love this team. He was very emotional with both Collison and Blake. Like, when Blake hit that and one, Paul was like, yes, like, let's go. And, like, after the game, those guys haven't always gotten along, and I think that's the subtext that they'll deny, but everyone kind of knows. They seem to be getting along this year, and it's really cool to see.
Yeah, completely agree with that.
Danny Granger should not play, by the way. He played 12 minutes in that fourth quarter. I get that he was productive, but he should not play.
I don't necessarily agree. I think I think that, amazingly, I don't mind him defensively in a lot of those matchups.
He shouldn't shoot. How about that?
That I'm fine with, yeah. I like the threat of him more than the application.
He and Beasley are trillion guys. They just need to be trillions.
Sure. They're the exact same guy.
All right, who do you like tonight?
I like Miami. I don't know what the line is. What's the line?
It's 2.5.
Yeah, I like Miami. I mean, Brooklyn's got to show me. You know, it's not that I don't believe in them. It's just I believe in Miami. And then I would love for Portland to get a game, but they've done nothing in this series to prove to me that this is going to happen.
You've been great in camp by there. You're like, but they're right there in the second half. If they can just...
If they can avoid getting down 20 in the first half, I think they've got a great chance.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not trying to be, you know, at Portland, it's weird because we do this with the playoffs. Portland really, I want to stress this, they have been great this year. They were a lot of fun to watch. They were the most fun team to watch the first half of the season. LaMarcus Aldridge getting the recognition that he has is great. Damian Lillard has evolved into one of my favorite players to watch. I had real big questions about his shot selection and overall game management last year. And it wasn't like he can't improve. It was just I need to see it first. Like, he's a rookie, but I need to see it. He's gotten there. I love everything about his game. I love, like, even you can talk about, you know, does he get enough assists? He makes passes when he needs to. He's a gamer. He plays hard. The defense – yeah, he's 24, and so there's a little bit of a – like, he doesn't have the improvement curve that a lot of guys do, but defense doesn't come with age. It comes with NBA experience.
Right.
And by the time he's 27, he's going to be decent to good. And then, you know, Wes Matthews was a beast this year. Nicholas Batum wasn't – I don't think was awesome, but he was pretty good. He was stable. Robin Lopez was great this year. I'm really glad that he's turned – he's gone from – Brooks' brother, is he going to have a career too? No, this is a guy that genuinely helps you win. Like, he's not
Jared Collins. He's not Harvey Grant. Although Harvey Grant was pretty decent, but he's not those guys. Like, he's a legitimate player.
Yeah. The bench wasn't as good, but I want to see another year of CJ McCollum. I actually do kind of like what Will Barton's given them a little bit. I would like to see. Let's see if Thomas Robinson can build off of something now. Now that he probably has a home, let's see.
Yeah, now that you've got a little bit of stability with him, like, see if he can build off that. I agree with that.
Yeah, I would like to see maybe another big that's not Myers Leonard or Joel Freeland that just just shooting the breeze there.
You would like an NBA quality big man?
Yeah, I like an NBA quality backup big man.
Right.
But you know, in general, the core is good. Whether they can make the Western Conference Finals in the future, you know, with that, if they don't get injured next year. Which, you know, Portland, but if they don't get injured next year, they're going to be a playoff team, I think, consistently every year. They're going to be a threat. Just if they can make sure that Aldridge buys into this and everyone stays, they're going to have a really great chance to go forward. I think that they're in really good shape.
And, I mean, you do have to, like, I know we keep waiting for it, but eventually the Spurs aren't going to be the Spurs anymore, right? At least for a couple of years as they rebuild.
Like, I mean, I'm waiting for having to, when they make the finals and if they win, like, I wrote last year that I thought it was over because I didn't think it sounds like I don't respect them, and it's not. It's just like I couldn't imagine coming back from that.
Yeah, like, it shows you the testament of those guys.
It shows you their character beyond all the basketball stuff. For Tim Duncan to have the heart to be like, no, I really want to compete. And a lot of that's that he doesn't get up and down. Like, he's not hyper emotional. Like, he's an emotional human being because he is human despite all the Duncantron jokes. Like,
debatable.
But he's also not erratic.
Yeah,
you know?
He's very reasoned.
Like, if that happened to me, I would have grown a hobo beard. I would have been like the dude in Dangerous Confession or Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Just holed up in my hotel room drinking, growing a beard. It would have been bad. If I was Boris Diaw, I would have been 700 pounds. Just
as opposed to a cool 650 that he is.
As opposed to a cool 650. Somebody called him the Walrus the other day, which I love as a nickname.
Oh, yeah. I got to figure out what Walrus is in French.
Yeah. Goo-goo-goo-goo. But yeah, so I just think it's really impressive that the Spurs, from an emotional standpoint, are back here. Now, I am a little bit worried if they make the finals and Miami's there and they're like, we're going to get revenge. But in the back of their mind, they're like, oh, God, I can't do this again. This cannot happen to me again. But yeah, like you said, like, there's going to have to be some team that fills that void, and you think it's going to be OKC, but weird things happen.
Yeah, my main point of that is just, like, you know, can Portland get to a Western Conference Finals? Well, the landscape will change at some point, And
somebody's got to.
And they're in position to take advantage of that as long as they keep things together and, you know, don't regress.
We're at an interesting point with OKC from what happens this year. I've long held this belief. Do you remember when Portland was that team that was on the rise,
yeah,
and had Brandon Roy and Greg Oden and everyone? And at the time, everyone's like, and yeah, LaMarcus Aldridge is fine. And I was one of the people that was like, LaMarcus Aldridge is awesome. Why does he not get more credit? But they were like the team that was like, this team is going to be a finals contender year after year after year. And it just didn't happen because of the injuries. I'm also similarly worried that, you know, OKC had its shot. It progressed every year. It made the finals. It missed. They've advanced from last year because they made it out of the first round. But that was, you know, I guess they made it out of the first round last year too. They got to make it past this Clippers team in order to have progressed. I worry about what happens when you have a steady level of progression and then you hit a roadblock and you go backwards.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's a thing of they had an excuse last year. There's no excuse this year. Like, yeah. Granted, the West is arguably better at the top this year than it was last year, but there is no excuse. Like, you have Westbrook, he's in full health. You have Durant, who's playing the best ball of his life. Like, you have really good role players. Serge Ibaka is the best he's ever been. There's plenty there. And it becomes a matter of, you know, mental toughness, not in the sense of shrinking from the moment, but just making sure you execute. And there's a huge difference in that.
Final thing before we go, Steve Kerr reported. Okay, there's some debate about this.
This kerfuffle needs to end.
The Post reported 5 year. He wants a 5 year deal, and they reported he wants the same deal that D'Antoni got at 4 years, 24. So I made this intuitive leap of, well, what's 5 years at $6 million a year? $30 million. I too could do multiplication. So he wants somewhere between 5 years, 24, and 5 years, 30. And my wife made the comment while she was making pancakes yesterday. You know, someday I hope I too can demand to be massively overpaid for a job I am massively underqualified for. She said, hashtag American dream. I was like, that was pretty amazing. Like, I'm sure Kerr will do a good job, but that's kind of where we're at. And yeah, you're right, it needs to end. But I don't think it's until the finals, because I just don't think he's going to – I think he's going to want them not to leak it until after the TNT thing's done.
Yeah. I mean, geez, maybe – hey, Pacers wrap this up, Heat wrap this up, and then it's time for the combine on Thursday that no one's going to be at.
I'm glad they're not doing. Those guys aren't doing it though.
Yeah, there's really. I just want to see the. I want to see the official measurements and like the verticals. That's the only thing I care about. I don't care if they actually participate in the stuff. I just want to see. I just like seeing that stuff for some reason.
I wish that they would leak more of the interview stuff. I know it's intensely personal and not. And then that's not at all fair or cool. But I just am interested in these things.
I wish they would do this horrible violation of trust.
Exactly. Like, I just want to know, like, the personal, like, there would probably be so many cool, anecdotes. Wouldn't it be awesome if somebody was like, I want you to, like, I want to opt to televise my interview? How bold would that be?
Oh, my God.
Wouldn't it be amazing?
That would be amazing. Hey, at least we get to check out Dante Exum.
We do. We finally get to see
him. We finally get to see him play basketball. It's going to be great.
When he shows up and it's actually, like, Andy Kaufman.
Surprise.
An elaborate ruse.
Now we're all going to get ice cream.
Oh my God, Stephen Marbury.
Oh God.
Thanks, Zach.
Thanks, Matt.